Okay, good afternoon. So last time we talked about processes, this illusion of a dedicated machine that our operating system creates for us so we can write a computer program kind of as if we have a whole machine to ourselves and don't have to worry about anything else going on except when we want to. And this was composed from two abstractions. So one was the thread. That was the dedicated processor piece. And this is how, where our operating system gave us the idea that we had our own CPU. Even though we had lots of programs we wanted to run at the same time and only so many CPUs. And the way the operating system did this is by alternating who actually ran on the CPU and storing that program state, what we call its context, elsewhere when it's not running. And we needed a mechanism supported by the processor to actually have the operating system run to do this. And that mechanism was exceptions. We also mentioned the address space, which is how we separated the memory of different programs that were on the machine at the same time. We wanted to give each program the illusion they had a dedicated memory. And this also required support from the processor. So the processor lets the operating system set a mapping from the addresses that appear in a normal program to what actual memory addresses are used by the processor. And by setting this mapping so that the addresses don't end up overlapping when we turn them into real memory addresses, the operating system can ensure that two programs can't interfere with each other. And so this gives us a concept I didn't mention by name, but that's a very important concept in operating systems known as protection, that processes can't interfere with other processes, and processes can't interfere with the operating system, that they're protected from each other. And we needed a little bit of help from the processor to implement this efficiently. And there's some exception here, is that the operating system might decide to let processes interfere with each other or have the operating system do things, but that's all chosen by the OS. The operating system gets to make the choices about when that happens. And our mechanisms for this, one was that we have these privileged instructions that let the operating system do things because it runs in a different mode, what we called kernel mode, where privileged instructions work, but it can make sure user programs don't run in that mode. And those privileged instructions that do special things that we don't want every program to be able to do, like change how exceptions work, don't work in the user mode, the non-kernel mode. And address spaces, which we'll talk a lot about next week. And we have exceptions as a way for the OS to actually control the access and not just prohibit processes from doing anything to the system, but to have a mechanism where the OS can decide to give the process an escape hatch. And the one we learned about was system calls, that processes can actually request services from the OS that require kernel mode. And the way that's done safely is by having the processor support exceptions to enter kernel mode, but not let the user program decide to enter kernel mode and do anything. So a question which came up in the other lecture, which I think is important to go over, is what about kernel mode and things like sudo? So if you haven't used something like sudo before, this is a command you run which lets your program have more permissions, like access files that you as a normal user can't access. And there's a related concept, there's things called super user or root or a user called system on Windows that have very extensive access to the system. And some people wonder, well, isn't this kernel mode? Because they can do anything, quote unquote. But that's not actually true. So programs always run in user mode, even if they're running with these so-called super user permissions. They still run in user mode. The difference is that some programs, the operating system might say when it gets a system call that, hey, I'll let you do that. Whereas other programs, it won't. So the difference is entirely in the operating system. The CPU doesn't know anything about these programs having extra permissions. It's all the operating system remembering, oh, I decided that you should be able to do more. So when the operating system handles that open system call for a normal program, it might say, not that file, that you can't access that. But for a super user program, it might say, okay, but it's still using a system call, then the program still needs to use a system call to access the file. And this gets us into a general category, as mentioned about processes, that we talked about sort of the very minimum stuff that a process has, just the state that's in the context, the stuff that's conceptually what's on the CPU when the process is running, and what the OS definitely absolutely needs to store in order to get it back running if it stops it. But operating systems are going to track a lot of extra information about processes that you might see. And this is information that the operating system just decided to keep track of. The CPU doesn't know about it. So, for example, you'll typically hear about a process ID. This is something the OS keeps track of, so it can figure out which process that it has stored in its memory is which. And so you, when you're making system calls, can refer to a process. Processes typically have a user ID. This is how the operating system knows what files, when you make an open call, should I let you access. And we also have things related to the state from those system calls. So when you open files, the operating system keeps track of that. So that state's going to be part of what the operating system considers a process. But because system calls are entirely implemented by the OS, and the CPU doesn't do anything besides run the OS, the CPU doesn't know about any of that. So if you take an operating system course, you'll learn all about maintaining all this extra data. But as far as what the processor does, it doesn't need to do this. It implementing exceptions and address spaces is enough. So any questions about this stuff from last time or anything else? From last time? Comments? Okay, apparently not, or not yet. So, last time I showed you our textbook's taxonomy of types of exceptions. We had our externally triggered exceptions, our interrupts. We had things from errors in programs. And we had our explicitly triggered exceptions, which the only kind we knew about were system calls. And there's one category here I didn't talk about last time, which is aborts. So aborts don't come up very often, but they do exist on pretty much any kind of machine. And what these mean is something is wrong with the hardware. So for example, a memory chip sometimes fails. It might have a junk value. And you'd like to your system to do something about that and not just keep using that junk value. So the abort is the way that the processor can tell the OS to do something about this. Now, if you know that some piece of memory has a value that doesn't make sense, your options aren't actually very good. You don't actually want to run a program that uses that value. So probably what you're going to do, if you're the operating system handling this, is reboot. But you still want to do something. You don't want to just keep running the program when you know that this hardware error has happened. So this is a mechanism that hardware uses to inform the operating system so it can reboot, or maybe if it's really clever, it can try to take some other way of recovering from the hardware problem. Okay, so those are all our types of exceptions. And I'd like to mention an issue that comes up with interrupts. So we've had this notion that we have an exception handler that, you know, saves a lot of state. And one thing we didn't talk about is, let's say I trigger another exception, an interrupt, while I'm running an exception handler. What's going to happen? So let's say we have our timer interrupt that the OS wants to take my infinite loop off the CPU, and at the exact same time that's running, somehow I have really good timing, and during that exact nanosecond, I press a key on the keyboard. So while we're saving the state, I have to press a key, and there should be a different kind of interrupt with a different interrupt handler happening right there. So what we'd expect to happen is that we'd run our code to handle a keyboard interrupt. And if you look at the way I've written our interrupt handler, we have a little bit of a problem. That I saved the PC of my infinite loop somewhere, and now in my keyboard interrupt handler, I'm overwriting that with this program counter, a pointer to some instruction in the timer interrupt. And that's really bad because now I've forgotten where I am in the program that was originally interrupted. So we need to make sure this doesn't actually happen. And the most commonly used solution for this is to not allow this interrupt to happen here. That we just say that we're not going to have an interrupt happen while you're doing this state saving. Then obviously it's going to need hardware support, or hardware needs to sometimes cause this interrupt handler to happen and sometimes not. So this is called disabling interrupts. So hardware is going to support some information to say, I'm not going to deliver interrupts right now. I know that you're doing something important where it would be really bad if I had an interrupt happen right now. Even though you want to respond to key presses quickly, you don't want to respond to them in a way where you forget where you are in a program. And so the typical way to do this is that we'll have some extra state. We'll have another 1-bit register, like we have the kernel mode register, saying, are interrupts enabled right now? And whatever decides how to change the program counter to deliver an interrupt is going to look at that before it actually changes the program counter. Now this means we also need to know that when I press a key on the keyboard, I just don't want that to be forgotten about. So I can't just ignore the key press forever. So instead of ignoring it forever, we're going to have some extra state saying, did I have something happen where I haven't triggered the interrupt handler yet? So the hardware is going to keep a register for each kind of interrupt saying, do I need to trigger an interrupt handler for this? So when I press a key on the keyboard, it will set this to 1, but interrupts will be disabled. So it will keep knowing that there's one pending until interrupts are enabled again. And when that happens, this logic will say, oh, I need to deliver a keyboard interrupt now. I need to run the handle keyboard interrupt function. Yes?
Is this only for interrupts within interrupts, or what if you have like a fault within interrupts?
So this generally is for exceptions in general, but you can avoid having a fault here easily. I can just write code that doesn't divide by 0 and doesn't access invalid memory. So it's not a problem for faults or traps, because I can write code that will, as an operating system writer, I know won't trigger that. But generally, we're going to disable interrupts even for normal fault handlers. We might actually disable delivery of faults, but that's not useful because we aren't going to trigger faults. We care about disabling trigger external events that we can't control when they happen. Other questions, comments? So we have this logic here. So what this interrupt enabled bit turns things into is that we have a key press happen here, but we actually disable interrupts automatically when we enter an exception handler of any kind. Just so the exception handler can safely save the state of the program and not forget where it was. So interrupts are disabled by the processor when we start here. And so even if I press the key here, that's just going to set this pending bit until interrupts are enabled again. And then at some point, I call a special instruction, a privileged instruction, to re-enable interrupts. And at that point, the interrupt will actually happen. And I can make sure I do that after I put my save state somewhere safe. So I have this hypothetical move save state function. And that might, for example, copy the save PC, save REX, and so on to a special stack. So I have a different place to put it each time an exception or interrupt handler happens. So at this point, it's safe for another program to start, exception handler to start use that save PC memory location. And this is the typical structure you'll see in operating systems because they do want to respond to key presses as quickly as possible. So they just do what little work they need to do to remember where they are, and then they enable exceptions again and interrupts again. Yes? So there's typically one bit for each kind of interrupt. So they're queued up in that sense, but there's not actually a queue. So in particular, if I press the multiple keys on the keyboard, there's only going to be one keyboard interrupt that will happen.
How do you know which one?
You don't. So the solution is that when you write an interrupt handler for a keyboard interrupt, you need to look for all the keyboard events you can. So you hope that the keyboard remembers enough characters you typed, and you just say, give me everything you have. And that's going to be the structure of interrupt handlers for all kinds of devices. The interrupt handler will ask for everything the device had on the assumption that they didn't get every single interrupt signal. So after we've done this, we enable interrupts, and because it was pending, it will happen immediately here. But this is safe now because we've copied that save PC. So we aren't going to forget where in the user program we were. And when we return from this handle keyboard interrupt, we'll return back to this other interrupt handler. So questions about this flow? So the most common case for disabling interrupts is just at the beginning of an interrupt handler, and that's going to be done automatically. But there's also going to be some privileged instructions to disable interrupts. And this is because, let's say I'm editing a data structure that's used by the keyboard interrupt handler. It's possible I could do it in a way where it would be safe no matter when I press a key on the keyboard, but that's really, really hard to do. So instead, operating systems are typically going to disable interrupts, then manipulate things the interrupt handler might use, and then enable them again. So they don't have to worry about the interrupt handler seeing part of a change to one of those data structures. But this obviously needs to be a privileged instruction because just like the case with my infinite loop, if I could change the exception table, it'd be really, really bad if I could just disable the timer interrupt from ever being triggered. So this is a privileged instruction along with enable interrupts. And these are not the real names of the instructions in any real system because no one likes long instruction names for some reason. So questions on disabling interrupts? Okay, so that basically concludes our tour of exceptions, then, with one little note on the real world. So we've been very careful to use nice, consistent terms for different kinds of exceptions. Our textbook has this taxonomy with interrupt, fault, trap, and abort. The real world does not do this. For example, if you read x86 manuals, they call every type of exception an interrupt. They just do that. You might see some manuals call exceptions to mean only faults. You might see the words hard fault used to refer to what we call aborts. You might see the word trap used to refer to what we call faults. All these sorts of things happen, and it just depends on who decided to write the processor manual. So you just in the real world, you should be prepared that these terms won't be used consistently. We are going to use the textbook terms in this course on quizzes, on exams. But if you read the x86 processor manual or pretty much any processor manual, you'll get a slightly different set of terms. So this is also true with the words kernel mode. So we use the words kernel mode, and you might see some other names. So some systems call it supervisor mode, or privileged mode, or ring zero. These are all just other terms for kernel mode. It depends on who wrote the processor manual, which one they use. Another thing is that we've talked about there being user mode and kernel mode. And that's all we have. And this is all you need. But in spite of that, many systems have multiple levels of privilege. So they have different modes which allow different size sets of privilege operations to work. So for example, x86, depending on how you count, has six or so levels of privilege. For reasons of history and people wanting more features. But it's only really important to have at least two, because that's enough to write an OS. But you might read about systems which have more, and where they'll have different modes with slightly different names and slightly different sets of privileged operations that work. Okay, so with that note on terminology out of the way, I'm going to give another view of processes. So I mentioned that processes give you the illusion of a dedicated machine. And sometimes people call this a virtual machine. So you've probably seen virtual machines in a different context, and we'll get to that in a bit. But it's a virtual machine in the sense that you program it like a complete computer. It's, you know, and it looks like a complete computer, but it has a kind of weird interface. It's a kind of weird kind of computer as far as how I/O and memory stuff works. That you use these system calls, which is not actually a natural way real hardware would work. So people will often refer to what operating systems do as creating a virtual machine for programs. But it's not really like a real machine so much. But we could make it closer. So instead of having this weird interface of system calls, we could make this interface really close to a real machine. And this is what you hear of being done by things which are called virtual machines, typically. And the central technique is, if you remember, I talked about privilege instructions triggering a protection fault. And we just assumed that what's going to happen when you have a protection fault is the operating system crashes the program for you. It just makes the program go away. But the OS has other options. So one thing it could do is it could pretend the privilege instruction worked. This is often known as trap and emulate. It's called trap because it churns that protection fault into a trap. Into something where instead of the program doing something it's not supposed to, it's requesting a service from the operating system to implement the privilege instruction. And in this way, the OS provides the same interface that the real hardware would provide. As far as the program is concerned, it runs a privilege instruction, and something happens, and the effects of the privilege instruction, whatever they're supposed to be, happen. So the way this might look in pseudocode is that we'll have our protection fault handler, and we'll say that we've somehow gotten the state of the process in a convenient C variable. And we'll just, instead of crashing, we'll say, let's say we want to support a privileged write something to the screen instruction. We'll say, well, was this instruction that caused this protection fault a write to the screen? And if so, I'm going to just do what I would do for a system call. I'm going to churn the protection fault into a system call. And then I'm going to skip ahead and go to the next instruction. So I'm going to edit the PC so I don't return and try to rerun the privileged instruction and trigger another protection fault. So I'm going to skip it because I executed it. So this is emulating the instruction. We're doing the effects of the instruction, including incrementing the PC. And we might do it in a slightly different way. The write system call might, you know, display things differently than a real computer would on a screen. But we're emulating something that's very close to the real machine. So one question you might have is how this was write to screen works. How do we actually know, you know, what kind of thing it was, if we just know it's a protection fault? So there are two basic options you might use. So one thing is we could have the hardware help us. The hardware could have like a special register or a special instruction we use which says, what kind of protection fault is it? Or we can have a different exception number for each type of protection fault. Another option that's more generic is that, you know, the operating system can read memory, just like the processor reads memory to try to execute the instruction. the operating system could extract the opcode of the instruction. It can read the instruction just like your simulated processor did, extract the bits of the opcode, and see if which type of instruction it is. So in this sense, what the operating system is doing is like writing a functional simulator for just these instructions that the processor won't handle natively. And unlike the processor handling it natively, it can choose what these privilege instructions end up doing and maybe do something nicer. So systems that do this are called system virtual machines, to distinguish them from process virtual machines, which look like your normal program you write in a normal OS. These emulate a real system, so they're called system virtual machines. And this is essentially what software like VirtualBox and VMware and Xen and things like that you may have used do. That they, instead of having their protection fault handler just crash a system, they turn the protection faults into system calls. So in reality, it's actually a lot more complicated than this. And the main reason is I haven't told you how address spaces work with this. So to actually emulate a real machine, we need to give the same capabilities for setting address spaces. But we can't tell you how that works because we haven't talked about how address spaces actually work. And that turns out to be the most complicated part of these. The handling privileged instructions is actually the easiest part, just because they're so close to system calls already in what happens. Another piece of complication is that on some platforms, like x86, there are privileged instructions which don't cause faults. They just do something different in user mode. And that's an extra challenge. The usual solution to that is to fix the hardware so they do cause faults. But there are other solutions that software has used historically. So questions about system virtual machines? So one of the reasons for my digression into this is that we're going to talk about something which is very much a process virtual machine feature that's trying to imitate a real machine feature. So we have I/O devices on real machines, which we imitate in processes and the process virtual machine with files and sockets and things that you access with system calls explicitly. We have CPU cores, which we've learned we imitate in real machines with threads. We talked about memory allocation, which doesn't really have an analog in a real machine because you can't just add memory by executing a special instruction. But we're going to have a process feature called signals. And signals are basically going to be exceptions for the process virtual machine, the normal way you write programs. As far as what they're emulating. So they're going to provide a very similar interface and capabilities to exceptions, but for normal programs. So signals are a feature that you'll see on Unix-like operating systems. So this is Linux, OS X. This is not Windows. Windows has other things that might be similar, but they're not called signals. And they're basically like interrupts and exceptions for processes. So they can be triggered by an external process. So if you've ever, who's used the kill command on Linux? So the kill command sends a signal. That's an example of something which does that. And there's also system call that the kill command uses internally, which does that. It can be triggered by special offense. So if I press Control C, so who's pressed Control C or Control Z? So you've done that. That triggers a signal. That's how that works. And it also can be triggered by faults, and we'll get into that in a bit. And just like an exception looks up something in an exception table, invokes an exception handler, you can set up a signal handler to be invoked when one of these signals happens. And it's very similar to an exception handler, except it's in your program, not in the operating system. So like every operating system feature, there's an API for this. And all of these have man pages, which you can look up. And each of these basically is a system call. So there's a system call to set the signal handler table called sigaction, where you specify which entry of the signal handler table you want to edit and what you want the signal handler to be. There's a command to send signals, one called kill. There's some things that aren't really analogous to things we have in exceptions. So for example, there's a system call called pause, which just puts the process to sleep until there's a signal. There's not really anything analogous on a real machine because you can't put a real machine to sleep, really. Well, you can, but we're not talking about that sort of feature. There's also something analogous to disabling interrupts called sigprocmask, which temporarily blocks signals. And blocking signals is basically the same as disabling interrupts as far as the effects. The signal will be pending. The operating system will keep a bit saying, are you waiting for this signal? And when you unblock the signal, just like enabling interrupts, it will send it to you. And there's a whole lot more other system calls or library calls that wrap obscure sets of system calls that deal with signals. So to make this more concrete, let's look at a real program that uses signals. And hopefully it would work. So here's a signal handler. I just write it as a normal function. I don't need to write any special assembly because we're trying a more convenient interface than a real machine would for exceptions. And I register it with sigaction. So to this sigaction, I pass this data structure, which I set up with the name of my signal handling function and a few bits of other information that aren't particularly important that you can look up in the man page. So then I just run normal code. And this signal I chose here is sigint. Sigint stands for interrupt, not a very good name. It happens to be the signal that control C turns into. So if you press control C while running a program, that will trigger sigint. And if I've registered a signal handler for control C, it will run that code. So this program, I have this infinite loop here, which, well, not infinite, but this loop here where I read from standard in. I type lines and read it. But when I type control C, instead of reading that control C, it's going to run this handle sigint function for me. And in this handle sigint function, I write got signal to standard out and then exit. And you may be wondering, why didn't I just use printf? Wouldn't that be much easier? And I'll get to that later. But there is a reason I'm not just using printf, and I'm doing this much more long-winded way of calling things. And also why I'm not using exit. I'm using something else, underscore exit. Other than that, any questions on how this works? Yes. That is how that works, yes. Okay, so I've shown you how you use signals from the API perspective. So let's talk about what happens if we're running something in here and I press control C. How does handle sigint actually get run? And the answer is going to be very similar to normal exception handlers that we have in the operating system. But we don't have to do as much work as an exception handler. So for example, you don't see any code in here to save registers. I'm not doing that. And the reason is that that's something the operating system is going to do. So if we're running some function foo, the operating system is going to write to the user stack to save those registers for it and also save the program counter. So all the information that we had the operating system writing code to put somewhere. Here, the part of how signals work is when you register a signal handler, the operating system will save all the old state. So you can just write a normal function and not worry about saving old state. So the operating system is going to add to the stack the program counter within foo where the signal happened, and the save the registers of foo. We need to save all the registers because foo doesn't think a function call is happening. So even ones which aren't callee saved need to be saved. So the operating system will just dump a copy of the old registers. And then we want to do a function call. And one thing we need for a function call is a place to return to. That's what's in the x86 is on the top of our stack when we do a function call. So we're going to put an address of something to go to. And you think that we might put the address of the PC where the signal happened. But that's not what we're going to do. And the problem with that, doing that, is that we have these save registers that the calling convention says that handle sigint doesn't need to save. So if we just jump back to where we were over here, we might have messed up one of those registers. So we need to go to code that's actually going to look at these saved registers and fix them. So to support that, what Linux does is they set the return address of the function, make it as if it's called from some function that is going to then use these saved registers. And the name of that on x86-64 Linux happens to be restore_rt for complicated historical reasons. So this is the stack setup. And in addition to setting up the stack this way, the operating system sets the PC to the beginning of handle sigint, to into our signal handler. So that's the same as executing exception handler in a real CPU was. We did this extra work to help save things and help make it look more like a normal function call, rather than relying on the user to know that it's not like a normal function call. So with the stack set up this way, I mentioned that we had a place to return to. So our handle sigint function runs, then it executes a return instruction. And that's going to pop an address off the stack. And because the operating system made sure it was set up this way, that's going to be the address of the special restore_rt. And here is the source to restore_rt. It executes a system call, one with number 15. And it happens on Linux that number 15 is called sigreturn. So sigreturn is a system call that's going to read the stuff off the user stack and the old PC, and then start executing the program again at that old PC. So this handles restoring all the caller saved registers that handle sigint might have modified. It also deals with unblocking signals, just like disabling interrupts, but that's not an important detail, but that's the big reason why it has to be a system call and it's not just some code which reads the save registers. So, questions on this? Not, we'll go back to the question of why I was writing using write and not printf, and using underscore xset and not a normal xset. But why would I do that? That's really annoying to do this, copy the string twice, size. And the answer is that really bad things could happen if I don't do that. So let's say I have some sigint function that just helpfully says you press Control-C, and I decided not to use write because that's annoying, and I just use printf. And maybe that will have this function foo, which happens to call malloc, and we're going to press Control-C in the middle of it. This code is not safe. It looks like it should work fine. There should be nothing wrong whatsoever. But this code, there's enough on here to know that this is not safe and could do bad things. And the problem, well, one of the problems is that the signal handler might happen while malloc is running. And we don't know what's in malloc, but let's consider a reasonable implementation. Maybe malloc has this global next to return variable, and we set that to something and increment it by the size we allocate. That's a very simple implementation of malloc. That's quite reasonable. So we just have this big memory space that we ask the OS to make bigger when we need to. And we just kick a pointer to the end and increment it. And let's say we get really lucky and I happen to press Control-C right after this assignment runs. And then I run printf. Now, a problem that isn't obvious is that printf, this printf here, it seems like it doesn't do anything that matters to malloc, but it might call malloc. Like printf has buffers. It needs to allocate some temporary space. It might not use the stack. It might use malloc. It's very common. So maybe it has a buffer that it keeps between calls, and maybe it allocates it with malloc. So now I'm going to end up calling malloc in the right here and manipulating this next return in the middle of that. So what this turns into is that we run foo, foo runs malloc, and malloc figures out what its return value is. Then we press Control C, and handle saving gets run by the operating system, saving the state of this malloc call. Then printf gets run, and that printf runs malloc again. And this malloc, hey, reads this same next to return, same value, and returns it. And now printf's buff, this buff here, is the same value that p has. That we have a malloc pointer that is being used by two things. So we're in trouble here. So later on, if I free that pointer or I change it, I might mess up future printf calls, or future printf calls might change that pointer. And this will be really, really confusing. This is basically impossible to debug. And this is something you have to worry about when you're writing signal handlers. So one of the rules of writing signal handlers is that if you are calling anything that might use malloc somewhere, your signal handler cannot call anything that might use malloc somewhere. That's a very restrictive rule, since you do not know how any of the standard library functions really are implemented. And you know, things like printf are likely to use malloc, so like all those facilities are off the table. So this actually makes signal handlers really challenging to use in practice. To be precise, so Linux and other Unix-like operating systems have some very specific rules about what you can do in signal handlers. So there's a standard called POSIX that most Unix-like operating systems follow. So Linux and OS X both try to comply with this POSIX standard. And POSIX has a list of what they call async signal safe functions. And these are the functions, and the only functions, that must work correctly in signal handlers. And if you want to know how to write safe signal handlers, you can look up what this list of functions is. So this list of functions includes write and underscore exit. That's why I use those, because I know they were on this list and they're safe to use in signal handlers. And what this means is that POSIX and Linux have guaranteed me that they've somehow written write in a way where even if I'm calling write and a signal happens, nothing bad will happen. Even if I call write in the signal handler, that signal triggers. That means that's pretty challenging to do if write does anything non-trivial. It happens that write is just a system call wrapper, which makes it much easier. But if it wasn't, it would be a lot harder. You can do it, but it's a lot of extra work. It's similar to writing thread-safe code, but actually harder than that. So for that, writing multi-threaded code is hard. Handling this sort of condition is harder. And notably, it doesn't include common functions like printf or malloc or exit. These functions, just as far as the standard is concerned, they're not going to tell you anything about what happens if you try to call them from a signal handler that might have been interrupting anything interesting. So our book goes into a lot of detail and stuff we didn't have you read about how to write safe signal handlers and things like that. This is not the approach I actually recommend in practice, and I'm puzzled that our book spends so much time on it. Instead, there are other ways of dealing with signals besides having something that looks like an exception. It's very nice that it's kind of a nice analogy to exceptions that you can actually do in your normal programs, But that's not actually useful in many cases where you want to use signals, where you want to do something when someone presses Control C. It's not useful if the things you do have to be very, very limited, where you can't use printf in that code. So one of the facilities that Linux and other Unix-likes provide to help you with this is blocking signals. So as I mentioned earlier, blocking signals is like disabling interrupts. And this lets you avoid having a signal handler called while you're doing something interesting. So you can control when the signal handlers get executed to places in your code that are safe to interrupt. And this is done with a sigprocmax system call. And just like with disabling interrupts, the signal will become pending instead of actually causing your signal handler to run. So the operating system will keep track of what signals are pending. And until you unblock, until you re-enable the signal, it won't deliver the signal. It won't actually call your signal handler or do whatever else the signal is supposed to do. And this is the basis of ways of handling signals that don't involve signal handlers at all, or involve signal handlers in cases where you know that what they're interrupting is safe, such that you don't have to worry about not calling malloc in the signal handler. And there are two basic approaches that you can use for that. So the start of each approach is you block the signal. So during most of your program, you don't want to run the signal handler. One approach is then there's some system calls where instead of having a signal handler, you make a system call and it looks directly at that list of pending signals and just tells you, wait until I have a pending signal of that kind. So sigwait is an example. It will look at the set of pending signals, see if you have it, and if not, it will put your process to sleep until you get one of a kind you specify. Another option is you can unblock signals only when you're waiting for I.O. So when you're waiting for I.O., you're not using malloc or anything like that, so it can be safe. And an example of how you do this is that there's something called pselect, which lets you say, wait for something to come in on a network connection or for a signal at the same time. You can unblock the signal and be waiting for something on a network connection. If your signal handler gets executed, that's fine, because you know that all you're doing is waiting. You aren't executing anything that is going to be manipulating the next to return thing in malloc. So to give an example of what using sigwait might look like, here we call sigprocmask. The setup is a little bit annoying. But we just say we with sigint, that control C signal, and then we call sigwait, wait for some duration that's specified elsewhere. And if we actually get a success, zero indicates success, we say, yeah, you press control C, we got a sigint. And this handles it without an actual signal handler. So in a real program, it would be common to have code kind of like this, maybe in a separate thread if you're writing a multi-threaded program, or to use the technique of waiting, only handling signals while you're waiting for I.O. You should obviously look up the man pages if you actually need to do this. I'm mentioning it mainly because I see a lot of people get in the trap of thinking, oh, that's a signal, I need to write a signal handler. And often you don't, and writing a signal handler just is very challenging because of this signal safety problem. Okay, so I've talked a lot about signals, and I've given you example of like control C, which is not the most interesting thing. But signals are used for a lot of other things. And one thing most of you have seen is they're used as a way to ask processes to terminate or to forcibly terminate processes. So they have some other uses. And they also are used for events which aren't user triggered. So sigint, we mentioned, that's control C. So there's also a signal if I close a terminal while my program is running. So maybe your program wants to clean up state. And if you want to do that, there's a signal that you can handle called sighup for hang up that tells you your terminal went away. Someone closed the SSH session running your program. So but the default action is that terminates your program. But maybe you want to handle the signal and save a file, for example. So this is a mechanism to do that. And you notice that with control C, I say the default action is to terminate. If you don't write anything to handle control C, your program terminates. And that's true for a lot of signals. So a lot of signals indicate events where usually, if you don't know what to do, you should get rid of the program. There's also sigchirm. That's the signal that kill sends. So most programs, when you send sigchirm, they don't have a signal handler set up and they'll just go away. But you could set up a signal handler for that if you wanted to clean something up before you terminate. I'd like to put your attention to probably the most interesting things on this list, including one type of signal you've definitely seen before and not realized it was a signal. So that's segmentation fault. SIG-SEGV, because they didn't have C compilers that supported identifiers of more than 7 characters at a point in time. So segmentation fault is a signal. So when the operating system gets a fault, like executing an illegal privileged instruction, it turns it into a signal. Usually, that crashes your program, because the default action here is to terminate your program. But you could handle this signal. Same is true for other types of faults, like illegal instructions. So this is similar to that sort of trap and emulate idea, except that they're not really doing something useful. But they're letting you handle this case. So this is something that some programs use, that when they do something that causes a fault, like access invalid memory, that turns into a signal. And they don't have to just crash. They can choose to take another action. And a common example would be that you could try to save a debug log when you access invalid memory by setting up a handler for segfault. You know, that's reasonable to do because even though you don't know if your program's in a good state, at least that debug log might be useful. You can also do more complicated tricks, like if you handle the illegal instruction signal, maybe you could have code in your program in like a library you link in that emulates the missing instruction for machines which don't have it. This is something that you have the flexibility to implement with signals. I would say that doing anything which handles signals like these that aren't like control C is very advanced and very, very system specific, but it's a common trick in some kinds of programs. So there's some signals I didn't show on this list which are special. And there's exactly 2 of them. One of them is sigkill. Sigkill, very strangely, is not the signal that kill sends by default. The signal that kill sends by default is sigchirm. And there's also sigstop. And these signals for sigkill always terminate the process. And sigstop always stops a process. And both of these cannot have a signal handler. You might be able to call sig action and register a signal handler, and maybe in some systems it won't even return an error, but it will never be called. When the operating system decides that to get the signal to a program, the program is terminated or stopped. That's it. And so in this way, signals double as a mechanism for controlling processes and not just letting processes do things. So any questions on signals? So I've been told that people in this class commonly ask how exceptions and Java, like try-catch, actually relate to anything we're talking about. Since we have something called exceptions, it seems kind of similar. But they're kind of a different thing. But I'd like to start by showing you C is closest equivalent to try-catch. And this is set jump and long jump. So we have set jump, where you pass a jump buff, which is some opaque data structure. And yes, you really do not pass a pointer, because history. And the first time you call it, it returns 0. And later on, in read file, we could call it with a call long jump, and that will make this return a different value. And we can know that some error happened, for example. So you can use this as an exception mechanism. So the idea here is that set jump is going to save the state of the program at that point, And there's going to be another function, long jump, which we'll call to restore the state, but return a different value. Not return 0, but return some other value. And the implementation of this is actually not too complicated in assembly. So set jump is just going to copy all the registers of the program to this jump buff, to ENV. And long jump is going to copy all the registers from ENV and just change the return value. So if you look at set jump, it basically looks like the first half of a context switch. The part where we save the state context somewhere, and the place we're saving it is that jump buff, that environment. So we move all the registers to there with some middle exceptions. So one of the exceptions is that we need to change, the stack is going to be in a slightly different place because we have the return address versus not. So we save the stack after the return address, and we save the return address instead of the actual program counter in the middle of set jump. But other than that, it's exactly the same as a context switch. So we're saving all the registers of the program into this environment, and then setting a return value of 0. So that's set jump. And in long jump, we just set the return value, restore all the other registers, and jump back to that program counter we stored earlier, which was the return address for set jump. So questions on how this works? So this gives us a way where set jump is try, sets up a try, and long jump is the throw. So long jump lets us go back to the set jump and execute some other code next to it. So this is very simple to implement in assembly, modulo, however this restore condition codes work, and the little trickiness about dealing with the return address. And is reasonably useful for doing something like exceptions. It does have some problems. So one thing I'd like to mention is the problems of correctness. So it turns out that setJump is a function that's part of the C standard. But the C standard is very loose about when you're allowed to use it. And this is an example of a program with undefined behavior. So are there any guesses as to why the C standard wanted this to be undefined behavior? So this program, where we should first execute this, increment x by 1, and then jump back to here and execute the printf. That's what it looks like it should do, but it's actually undefined behavior. So why would this not be defined? What's the problem here? So to help you figure it out, let's think about where is x stored? What are some possibilities about where x is stored? So it's a local variable. Okay. So where would that be stored? So it could be on the stack. Anywhere else it could be? Could be in registers. And in fact, it could be in both. It could be in registers here and on the stack here. And that means that setJump is saving a value in a register here. And that value that setJump saved is restored here, meaning we've lost this write. And this is because we don't have the compiler being told that, hey, this piece of code is going to be executed after here. So it doesn't know to keep x in a consistent location. It's keeping x in the location it expects it to be after this if else. And that's going to be on the stack, for example, even if it starts in a register up here. So to deal with this and to let C implementers implement setJump and longJump in the easy way I showed you, the C standard decided that they're just going to say this is not defined, that you can't do this. And if this were just generally the case, this makes set jump and long jump seem extremely useless. If like, you can't use local variables, that seems really bad. Fortunately, there's a workaround. So there's a keyword in C called volatile, which is very poorly understood. But one of the things it is actually useful for is making set jump and long jump do what you actually expect. So what volatile typically is implemented as is it keeps the variable in memory, so on the stack in this case, rather than ever having it be in a register. And that's going to be enough to ensure that set jump doesn't try to save a register containing x and restore it. That it's always going to be something in memory, so it's not going to be something overwritten by a long jump. So that's the fix, and this is actually defined behavior. This is a particular exception for set jump, regardless of what volatile actually does. But typically, the reason it works is that volatile stores it on the stack, guaranteed, and not, or in memory otherwise, not in a register. Okay, so I've shown you something which can implement something like try-catch, where we have this throw which goes to here, even though it's not on the direct line of control, it can even work inside a function. And this could be the way, and used to be the way, that try-catch was implemented on many systems for like C++. But it's slow. In particular, the problem is that set jump is slow. Like, we don't care if long jump is slow so much, but set jump being slow is really bad because exceptions, you know, these long jump calls are rare in something like a Java program. And we want the try to be really fast. We don't want try to be slow. So it turns out that there's a much faster way, which is typically the way that C++ compilers these days implement exceptions, or try catch, I should say. And I'll try to illustrate that with this little example here. So here we have read file, throws an IO exception, and here we catch it. So with set jump, this try turned into a set jump call, and the catch was the else part of the if with that set jump call, and this throw was a long jump. Here we're going to do something different. In particular, our goal is going to be to have absolutely no code run specific to try catch. In the case where we don't call this throw, that we're going to do absolutely no extra work where we don't call throw. And the way we're going to do that is by making the throw operation considerably harder to implement. And by also asking the compiler to provide extra information for us. So here's an example of the assembly here. And I've marked off where the try is, and here's the catch. And we'll have some function that the compiler generates a call to do the throw. And notice that I do not have any code indicating that we started the try or ended the try. I just have some labels in my assembly. And what we'll do is we'll have, separate from the code, a lookup table saying, where is the try? And this lookup table will say, from start try to end try, if you get an exception there, you should go to this main catch. So we'll say, from that range of code, go to this main catch. We also need to know what to do about read file. Here's where we're calling do throw. We need to know how to get back to this part of main. So we're going to have instructions on how to do that. So we know at the end of the function we call, restore a register and then return. So we're going to say that this is the sort of instructions on how to figure out where this function was called. And what do throw is going to do is that it's going to look at its return address. So it's going to peek at its return address on the stack. And it's going to look that up in this table. It's going to say, oh, it's in the read file to end read range, somewhere in there. And it's going to look at these actions and say, OK, so I'm going to try to pop R12 from the stack. And then I'm going to do what return would do and set the PC I should be looking at to be here at ntry. And this table says, to recurse, that we haven't found our exception handler yet. Our catch yet. And so it's going to try this again. So it now has a PC at ntry, and it's going to look that up in this table and say, oh, I need to go to main catch, and oh, this table says I'm done. I found where the catch is. And after that, it's going to just start executing here. And notice that I have like sort of x86 code here, but it's not real x86. We don't actually return. DoThrow has this sort of virtual machine that it keeps around, where it tracks what the PC is and does what these instructions say with that PC. And also tracks what the register should be and does what the instructions say with those registers. And finally, when it figures out where to go, it restores the registers and sets the PC. So this DoThrow, especially if we have like lots of nested function calls, is a lot more expensive than long jump. But we didn't do any extra work in the case where DoThrow was never called. Our cost was just that our executable is probably larger because we have to have this lookup table for everything that might have a throw happen from it. And this is also a lot of extra complexity for the compiler because the compiler needed to have the logic to generate, oh, I saved R12 on the stack, you need to get that back. But this is typically the technique that you'll see real C++ implementations at least, used to implement exceptions. These are often called unwinding tables because they take the program back to an older state conceptually. So questions about try-catch implementation? So that's what I have for today. So to remind you what we talked about exceptions as the mechanism for the OS to run, and we talked about some analogies to exceptions in signal handlers, and also about the other kind of exceptions, the try-catch, and how that's actually quite different, how that was implemented. And our key concept that this entire week is this process, the virtual machine illusion that operating systems create from a thread plus an address space. And next time, Luther's going to talk a lot about the address space in particular. We kind of just said there's a mapping here. We haven't said what that looks like. We haven't said how that's managed. We're going to go into lots in detail, probably over like 2 or 3 lectures, about how that works. And I guess I'm done a little early.